Commissioner Kemp stated in his memo that he essentially is taking a different stance than the governor.
Governor Walker asks the state transportation commissioner to resign. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, January 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Lonnie Dupree supporters celebrate his successful Winter Denali Summit.
Well, we were concerned because the winds were picking up high, and it was gusting to 30 knots, and it didn't look like a place you'd want to be.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing are important to you, please consider applying for one of 35 seats open on your Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Councils. The seats will be filled by rural Alaskans who are knowledgeable about fish and wildlife resources in their region. Apply by January 23, 2015. Information at 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
The head of the State Department of Transportation and Public Facilities, Commissioner Pat Kemp, stepped down today. Walker's spokeswoman Grace Jang says Walker accepted Kemp's resignation because their philosophies and objectives were not aligned. Jang says on December 24th, Walker sent out an administrative order directing agencies to halt discretionary spending on six projects and to submit funding status reports on those projects. Jang says Kemp's position on the Kinnickarm Bridge and the Juneau Access Road were at odds with the governor's position.
Commissioner Kemp stated in his memo that he essentially is taking a different stance than the governor. And like I said, all commissioners serve at the pleasure of the governor.
For his part, Kemp says he didn't resign, he retired. He says he had already emptied his desk when the new administration asked him to stay on as acting commissioner. He says he thought the memo was a status report, not a position paper.
Well, I'm surprised at that. I sent the memo in to the governor or to the OMB director and just gave the facts on the two projects about federal aid payback and things like that. I had no idea that I was not in line with the governor's ideas.
In his memo, Kemp said halting or delaying the projects likely will result in penalties from federal funding agencies. He said they'd been authorized by repeated legislative appropriations and are cost-effective opportunities to improve transportation. Alaska Congressman Don Young was sworn in today for his 22nd term, having missed the main swearing-in last week due to the death of his brother. Recent research by two political scientists say Young is one of the 20 most effective lawmakers in the U.S. House. Nationally, though, he is more known for his big, sometimes brash personality. APRN's Liz Ruskin has the story.
Young is starting the term a week later than his peers, but he's ready to drop a passel of bills.
We will be introducing a whole bunch of them. I believe I've got it back here, don't I? ANWR, of course, 49, Nick Black, Bakken Mountain area, the kiln drying bill, Alexander Creek recognition bill. We're going to move that finally. Alaska Native Migratory Bill, Alaska National Archives Bill, Alaska Native Corporation Conservation Easements Bill.
If the past is any guide, he stands a better-than-average chance of getting his bills to move through Congress. In a new book by two political science professors, the Alaska congressman is held up as one of the most able Republicans in the House of Representatives.
Now, the reason why we wrote him up in the book and list him as among our top 20 representatives over the past 40 years is that he keeps coming up in the top 10 in his party.
That's Craig Volden of the University of Virginia. He and co-author Alan Wiseman analyzed all of the House bills introduced from 1973 through 2012 to gauge the legislative effectiveness of each member.
So we traced what did they sponsor, how far did it move through the process, how was it reported on, what did they say about why they were pursuing the legislative strategies they were, and so on.
Volden says Young scored highly year after year. He was 11th in his freshman term out of nearly 200 Republicans. Eight times, according to their formula, Young was the number one most effective Republican. When he chaired the House Natural Resources Committee, Young was really at the top of his game, Professor Volden says, even when compared to other chairmen.
Traced all of the chairs of that committee, and he was right on par with Mo Udall, who famously ran that committee for over a decade. And committee chairs, we find, are effective for a variety of reasons. Some are effective because they draw attention to new issues or they reach across party lines. And it seemed that in that position, Representative Young used both of those sets of skills.
And yet, these aren't the qualities that typically earn Young national headlines. He's better known for his feistiness and brash remarks he sometimes has to apologize for. Even the animal heads in his office have drawn more attention than his legislative effectiveness. Professor Volden says these qualities weren't part of the research.
Yes, so we are aware of that, but that played no role in how we were generating our measures.
Volden says a key reason for Young's success is that he specializes. In the book, Volden describes Young's legislative strategy as all Alaska, all the time. Zach Fields, spokesman for the Alaska Democratic Party, says it's not so impressive.
These academics, in trying to assess Don Young's efficacy, have said that he's a specialist in Alaska, and you would certainly hope that he would, since he's the only Alaska member.
Fields knocks the study's methodology because it only looks at bills a member sponsors, so it doesn't take into account the laws a representative passes by, say, tucking them into must-pass legislation. Young says he's not surprised by his high rankings because he's keeping track, too. And he says if that's not what he's known for, well, that's all part of his M.O.
It is something I've used all my life, that I try not to appear, and it's not hard to do, very bright. So it throws people a little bit off.
Young says to achieve what he's elected to do, he uses every wily tactic he can. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
History has been made on North America's highest peak. On Sunday, Lonnie Dupree became the first solo climber to summit Denali in the month of January. KTNA's Philip Manning has more.
The news of Lonnie Dupree's summit came out early on Sunday afternoon. His support team received a message from Dupree's GPS locator that he'd made it to the top of North America's highest peak. This attempt to be the first successful January soloist on Denali is Dupree's fourth. His previous three tries were thwarted by bad weather high on the mountain. Last Thursday, Lonnie Dupree shared via satellite phone his thoughts on being held back by poor conditions.
There's nothing worse than having to stay put, especially when you got 18 hours of darkness every evening. It makes for a very long night. And, of course, it's just always having the weather pull the rug out from under you when you were psyched to go somewhere that day or do some climbing.
The weather did eventually break and allowed Lonnie Dupree to make a summit attempt on Sunday morning. According to his GPS tracker, he reached the summit just after 2 p.m. After receiving the GPS notification, Talkeetna Air Taxi pilot Paul Roderick says he took a plane up in an attempt to spot Lonnie Dupree on the descent, which can be just as dangerous as the climb in the winter.
We were concerned because the winds were picking up high, and it was gusting to 30 knots, and it didn't look like a place you'd want to be. But from the report that I just got, that when he summited, it wasn't as windy. It was relatively light wind, but he could feel it picking up, and he just raced off the top.
Paul Roderick says he began looking in the area of the summit, fearing that Lonnie Dupree had been pinned down by the increasing wind. Then, with daylight fading, he started to look lower on Denali.
We made it down lower to about 17, and we were getting knocked around pretty good at 17 by the time we saw him. But luckily, he had his headlamp, and that's the first thing. As I was looking at the 17 camp, just maybe 10 minutes out, we could see this, light beaming up at us, and we're like, God, there he is. So it was good to see.
With weather potentially building to the south, Lonnie Dupree is not wasting any time in his descent. Paul Roderick says Dupree left his camp at 17,200 feet before 4 a.m. on Monday and could reach base camp by Tuesday afternoon, where he will await his flight back to Talkeetna. In Talkeetna, I'm Philip Manning.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, carving sculptures out of ice in Anchorage with chainsaws.
Really, the reward is starting and finishing and not getting injured and creating something beautiful.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you're not covered by health insurance, you may be eligible for financial help with monthly premiums and out-of-pocket expenses. Open enrollment ends on February 15th. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Last year, 88% of Alaskans who enrolled received financial assistance. Compare plans and see if you qualify for financial assistance. Call 211 to get free local help. Visit getcoveredalaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by ASHNA, a partner of Get Covered Alaska.
The Juneau Assembly will vote tonight on two measures restricting the manufacture, sale, and use of legal marijuana in the city. Alaska voters approved recreational pot in November, but the new law doesn't take effect until next month. After that, it'll take another 9 months for the state to enact regulations governing commercial retail and grow operations. In the meantime, the Assembly hopes to give the city time to cautiously consider local regulations. But not everyone is happy with that approach. KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
One of the reasons Gianno Barrett moved to Alaska almost 7 years ago was because the state already has pretty lax marijuana laws. The 1975 Raven v. Alaska ruling by the state Supreme Court allows residents to possess a small amount of pot for personal use. Barrett, a 33-year-old Minnesota native, says he's already growing marijuana with his brother in a house they share in Juneau.
Right now it's 6 plants. I'm sticking to the guidelines that Alaska has stated.
Andy insists it's all for personal use. You're not selling it to people on the streets?
Absolutely not.
Why make that choice?
Well, I really don't want to get in trouble.
But Barrett says he's looking forward to the day he can legally sell pot. He and his brother have signed on to a reality TV show chronicling their operation. He's not currently working and says they're putting all their efforts into expanding what they grow now. Eventually, he says they want an outdoor cannabis farm to supply retailers around the state. They'd offer tours to capitalize on Juneau's visitor industry and help others grow marijuana, something he says they already do now.
You can grow cannabis. It is a weed. It'll grow. But it's really hard to grow in a quality form.
But the Juneau Assembly plans to pump the brakes on Barrett's dream grow operation. Two ordinances on Monday's Assembly agenda would restrict, at least temporarily, legal pot in the capital city. The first is a 12-month moratorium on land use permits for marijuana-related businesses. The second would add toking up to the city's ban on indoor smoking in workplaces. Assemblymember Jesse Keel.
Right now, in Juneau, you can have a greenhouse with a retail sales counter in any type of neighborhood in town. So think about quiet little residential neighborhoods where we don't allow bars and liquor stores. You would be able to come in and get a permit to open up a marijuana greenhouse and retail sales counter there.
The city's law department tells the Assembly that any permits granted now would likely be grandfathered if restrictions were adopted later. Keel says the moratorium is intended to give the city time to figure out where and when pot-related businesses should be allowed to operate. It would expire before the state starts to issue business licenses for legal marijuana enterprises, and it's not a blanket ban on sales like a proposal before the Anchorage Assembly last month. Keel himself supported the ballot measure legalizing recreational marijuana.
Voters in the state of Alaska passed this initiative. Voters in Juneau voted for it by a very strong margin. And what the people voted to do, I think the Assembly now needs to implement.
He does think the 12-month moratorium might be longer than the city needs to figure out its zoning issues, and says if that's the case, he'd support a shorter timeline. As for extending the city's indoor smoking ban to include pot, Keel says he's not interested in seeing Juneau overrun by hash bars, but mostly he says the measure is designed to protect the health of employees.
Some people just need a job, and your job shouldn't come with a contact buzz.
The Assembly will take public comment before voting on the measures. Even though he says he understands the desire to be cautious, Gianno Barrett plans to speak against the moratorium.
We don't want to send a message to other communities and say, hey, you can just stall this out. The message here needs to be that we need to keep moving forward, and we can work through all this stuff.
He says potential marijuana entrepreneurs want to work within the rules established by the city, but the longer it takes to set up those rules, the more uncertainty it creates. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Before heading to Juneau, Anchorage legislators are listening to community input on ways to cut state spending. They hosted a listening session on Saturday at the Lusac Library. Some community members urged the legislature to cut local capital projects like the UMed District Northern Access Road. Anchorage resident Kaylin Saxton told legislators that money should be redirected from the road project because it would not help current traffic problems on Burgaw near East High or the Alaska Native Charter School. She said the money should be given to the school district instead. State House Minority Leader Chris Tuck from Southeast Anchorage says funding for some local capital projects should be redirected.
We're not going to be able to fund every project, and especially the controversial ones. So I think that this is an area that we may have to hold back for a while and start making sure that we take care of the necessary needs that the public expects from us.
Tuck says that includes the money for the $20 million UMed Access Road and the $2 million South Anchorage High School Stadium. He says state funds can be reallocated, though projects with federal funding are more complicated. Representative Gabrielle Ledoux, a Republican from Northeast Anchorage, says she won't comment on which Anchorage projects should or should not be funded.
You know, I'm just going to wait until we get down to Juneau and hear all about these projects. I'm not going to speculate right now as to what I want to get rid of and what I want to make sure happens.
Ledoux says she will also be looking closely at how the Anchorage School District is spending its money. Community members spoke both in favor and against increasing education funding during the listening session. The state's legislative session begins January 20th. The community of Adak depends on its fish processing plant for jobs and tax revenue, but they've struggled to keep the lights on over the years. Now the plant's latest operator is looking for new partners to help shoulder the financial burden. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal has more.
The Adak Cod Cooperative formed in 2013 when two businessmen with experience in salmon fisheries decided to branch out. They signed a 20-year lease for the facility on Adak, and they agreed to pay more than $2 million to the city government for the equipment inside. But after one season processing Pacific cod, the owners decided they couldn't continue on their own. Rudy Sukata is the president for Aleut Enterprise, which owns the factory building. He says it presents a lot of financial challenges.
From our perspective, that facility, I would not say it's a huge moneymaker, if any. It's more of an economic driver for the entire community. And, of course, that includes fuel sales for my subsidiary as well.
The high cost of energy has been a stumbling block for some tenants. When Icicle Seafoods walked away from their lease after just 2 years, the company cited concerns about the Pacific cod stock. But Adak Cod Cooperative is still in the picture. Sukata says they've been negotiating with large processing conglomerates and smaller businesses to take over operations. As far as the landlord is concerned, Sukata says,
we'd love to have both. You know, we have 15 to 20 million pounds of potential cod landings for the Tridents, the Icicles of the world. But we also have room for things like the specialty live crab, decent halibut fishery, as well as a black cod fishery.
Those products could be packaged up fresh and flown off the island, generating revenue from air freight. Adak City Manager Leighton Lockett says that's especially important now that the community's federal flight subsidies are up for renewal. Alaska Airlines has been flying jets to Adak under a $4 million essential air service agreement. Before it expires in October, the Department of Transportation is taking proposals from interested airlines. In the meantime, Lockett and Sukata say the deal to run Adak's fish plant could be done by the end of January. In on Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2015 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or learn more, go to SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
The Fairbanks Daily News Miner will soon begin charging a fee to frequent visitors to its website. The so-called paywalls are a growing trend in the U.S. newspaper industry, used by some as a way to recover revenue lost to online news sites. But many in the newspaper industry disagree over whether paywalls hurt or help online readership. And as KUAC's Tim Ellis reports, that disagreement is being played out between Alaska's top two news sites.
Paywalls erected by some news outlets in recent years haven't gone over so well, especially among younger online readers, many of whom have stopped visiting those websites and gone elsewhere online, citing what's become a sort of mantra for 21st century news consumers: information wants to be free. But Newsminer publisher Marty Buscaglia says it costs money to pay the reporters and editors who work at the heart of a newspaper, and that's the idea behind the electronic subscriptions that the Newsminer will begin offering later this month.
There are few trusted sources that are bringing you the real news, and those trusted sources have decided that people need to pay for the news.
Buscaglia says there's really nothing new about that idea.
They've always paid for the news. You've always paid for subscriptions. The printed product.
The publisher of Anchorage-based Alaska Dispatch News sees it differently. Alice Rogoff says she took down the paywall that the Anchorage Daily News had set up after she bought the newspaper last year and combined it with the Dispatch News.
It's just not something we have ever thought made sense.
Rogoff raised eyebrows in the newspaper industry in April when she bought the Daily News from the McClatchy Company, the third largest chain in the United States, and rebranded it the Alaska Dispatch News. Rogoff says she intends to continue printing the paper, but she doesn't plan to bring back the paywall because she believes online news readers have already become accustomed to free news over the internet, and she says it's a hard sell to start charging for it now.
In a perfect world, if we were to start the world from scratch, it would make sense that people would pay for news content like they do when they pick up a newspaper for a quarter or a dollar, whatever the price is. But it's not a perfect world. And the way your news product gets seen by the people you want to see it and read it is by letting it be out there for free.
Buscaglia agrees there's a lot of free news online, but as the saying goes, you get what you pay for. She says the internet is awash in false information, and she subscribes to the school of thought that readers will pay for reliable news, especially from a local outlet.
Everything's vetted, and, you know, everything has multiple sources, and bringing that kind of news to the general public costs money.
Rogoff notes that many newspapers have imposed paywalls only to pull them down after suffering declines in online readership. And she says the Dispatch News doesn't need a paywall because the company earns enough through its online advertising.
As long as there are sponsors and advertisers who are willing to pay to help deliver what they think is a good environment in which to show their advertising, and then this model is going to continue working just fine in Alaska.
Buscaglia came to the Newsminer in May after having worked 2 years as vice president of advertising for the Anchorage Daily News. She says the Newsminer is in good shape financially and has solid support from its advertisers and the community. Buscaglia says the electronic subscriptions are intended to sustain its newsroom's ability to generate content for both its print and online versions on into the future.
The Newsminer has been around for more than 103 years, and it needs to be around for 100 more in whatever form is available in 100 years.
Buscaglia doesn't think the Newsminer website will lose many readers over electronic subscriptions. She says the site attracts an average of 1 million unique visitors and 3.4 million page views monthly. She says the online subscriptions will be required only for those who read more than 30 stories on the site over 30 days. A 30-day subscription will cost $9.99. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Artists wielding chainsaws and drills spent 3 days this weekend carving blocks of ice into salmon and sea dragons in downtown Anchorage. KSKA's Zachariah Hughes stopped by to check out all the things you can make with a 1.5-ton block of frozen water.
The Crystal Gallery of Ice is a series of sparkling ice sculptures spread over the winding walkway of Town Square on Anchorage's 6th Avenue, just under the Performing Arts Center. Families and smartphone photographers alike swarm around two figures inspired by Pablo Picasso's Cubist paintings.
The piece is called Symphony in Ice. We wanted to make musicians, so one is a tall bass player, and the other one is a guitar, or you could say it's a mandolin, depending on the size.
Carol Luando is an art teacher for the Anchorage School District. Her and her husband have carved a piece in the annual event for the last 15 years. They're one of 8 teams competing, and Luando is putting the finishing touches on the glassy surface of the stocky mandolin/guitarist as the sun sets.
And once we get pretty much finished, then we start playing around with texture. So the ice has this beautiful transparent quality to it, and also it's amazing how the ice, all our pieces have all transformed from a 3,000-pound block of ice that was 6 feet tall by 4 feet by 2 feet, and it's just fascinating.
This particular type of ice is called Arctic Diamond. It was hauled down from Fairbanks by rail and road through corporate donations. The 3-day event is sponsored by the Anchorage Downtown Partnership, drawing teams from all over Alaska and as far away as China. Luando loves how easily ice can be molded into new shapes with chainsaws and chisels, and the way sunlight, temperature, and wind all change the work from minute to minute.
Really, the reward is starting and finishing and not getting injured and creating something beautiful.
A sculpture of a mythical dragon titled Kirin by William Hartgrove and John Trescott took first place. But Symphony in Ice made off with the Carver's Choice Award. Luando hopes people will come and look at the works now through February as the weather reclaims each statue. But with ice carving, that's par for the course. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
You can see pictures of Symphony in Ice and other works on our website, alaskapublic.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Jacqueline Estes, Ann Hillman, and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, and Tim Ellis in Fairbanks. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Enroll now in the health insurance marketplace. Sign up at healthcare.gov. Open enrollment ends February 15th. Depending on your income, age, and family size, you may be eligible for discounts that may lower your monthly cost and out-of-pocket expenses. Pick a plan that is right for you and your family. Call 211 for free individual assistance about the health insurance marketplace. Visit GetCoveredAlaska.org for more information. This message sponsored by ASHNA, a partner of Get Covered Alaska. The Federal Subsistence Board meeting is Wednesday, January 21st through Friday, January 23rd, 2015 at the Dena'ina Civic and Convention Center in Anchorage. The meeting is open to the public either in person or by teleconference. Public comments and input on the proposed changes to federal subsistence fish and shellfish regulations is being sought, along with specific fisheries proposals. Meeting materials found at regulations.gov. This message sponsored by U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.